Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sassano. Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Ether. Today, I have Nadav Hollander on the podcast. Nadav is the founder and CEO of Dharma, which is a platform for building globally accessible lending products using programmable tokenized debt on Ethereum. To me, it's a vital component of the open financial movement. Thanks for joining me today, Nadav.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's a pleasure.
I'm sure most of the listeners are familiar with Dharma, or you know, have at least kind of heard the name as we kind of build out this open finance platform on Ethereum. But I'd love to dive into the history a little bit to understand how it got started. So can you first kind of walk us through your background and how you got interested in Ethereum?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was studying computer science at Stanford in 2015, and I made a bet on taking a class called Bitcoin and Cryptocurrencies when it was kind of the first iteration of that class. And at the time, they could barely even get the classroom filled because there wasn't enough interest. And I just absolutely fell in love with the ecosystem and just, you know, just fundamentally came out with the belief that this is the most exciting thing happening in technology and that this is, you know, what I wanted to spend like the better part of my career working on. And so I ended up meeting Fred Ersom in that class because he came in and gave a talk. And that eventually led to me working as an engineer at Coinbase. And, you know, at the time I was at Coinbase from probably around like summer of 2016 to like January of 2017 or so. And it was a really exciting time for Ethereum in general because it finally kind of felt like Ethereum was becoming this thing that wasn't just like an academic concept, but was actually something that you could like build stuff with. You know, the DAO had just happened that had suddenly proved that, you know, a lot of money can be raised with Ethereum and you know, a lot of money can be lost in the Ethereum ecosystem as well. And so it was just a really, really engaging time and place to be with regards to the Ethereum ecosystem. And, you know, especially at Coinbase at the time, people were really excited about Ethereum. And so that's kind of what got me involved in the community.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I'm sure that was a very exciting time to be at Coinbase. I mean, it was an exciting time in kind of the community and ecosystem in general. So I'm sure kind of working where all these tools and the exchanges were being built out was a lot of fun. So how did you kind of go from, you know, your background at Stanford and kind of taking this class and then working at Coinbase and then deciding that you wanted to build a tokenized debt platform on Ethereum?
Yeah. So, you know, at the time when I was at Coinbase, I was really struck by the fact that there is just so much crypto in Coinbase's coffers that's just kind of like sitting there stagnant. Like if you had your money in a bank account just sitting there, it's usually like accruing you some sort of interest rate because ostensibly that bank is going around and, you know, using that money to issue loans to people or do whatever it is that they do that yields you some sort of interest rate. But, you know, at the time and still for the most part today, like in most kind of crypto custodial platforms that exist out there, your money just kind of sits there. And that's just tremendously tremendously uncapital efficient model. And I kind of was like enamored by this idea of like, you know, we have borderless, stateless currency that is accessible from anywhere in the world. How cool would it be if you could have borderless, stateless lending and savings and borrowing and all the kind of suite of financial services that go beyond just simple point-to-point payments, but have them similarly available in a sort of borderless, stateless, and globally accessible context. And so basically the kernel of the idea was formed around this concept of like, can we build a decentralized peer-to-peer lending marketplace for cryptocurrencies? A marketplace in which people could borrow and lend cryptocurrencies with one another and like relatively low counterparty risk and do it in a way that there's not a kind of central operator that has to, you know, jump over a whole bunch of hurdles from both a regulatory standpoint and operational standpoint and et cetera. You know, at the time this had been tried in a centralized context, BTC Jam was kind of a well-known experiment in the Bitcoin community where they kind of tried to create a Bitcoin-based peer-to-peer lending platform. And, you know, the stories from that platform's history are truly fascinating. Like, there's some really, really inspiring stories of people accessing loans and building businesses and kind of changing their lives using Bitcoin, you know, at a time when they wouldn't have been able to access credit otherwise. But also, you know, BTC Jam was like a centralized platform based, you know, domiciled in the U.S., and just ran into huge, huge regulatory walls in trying to create this kind of fully globally accessible peer-to-peer lending platform. And so, you know, this really inspired me to think, like, what if we could create a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that is as sort of permissionless, distributed, and, you know, resistant to singular points of shutdown as the underlying blockchains themselves. And so that was the kernel of the idea that I ran with and eventually was able to enter Y Combinator with when I started working on Dharma. And since then, you know, we have built several versions of the system. It has evolved considerably. It has taken elements from projects like 0x. It has taken inspiration from a really, really wide variety of sources. And we were able to ship the first version of Dharma onto mainnet in May of last year. And so really, really proud to say that. And, you know, we'll go more into what it is that we're doing nowadays with Dharma and what we're focused on. But that's kind of the brief history.
Great. Yeah, I mean, I've been kind of following it from day one. It's one of my favorite projects. And it's no secret that I'm ultra bullish on the open or decentralized finance movement. There's a lot of debate on if it should be called open or decentralized these days. But, let's just combine them. And I think Dharma, in my opinion, is a cornerstone to that movement. So I think you guys are doing great work. I think that's a great background. I'd like to dive deeper into kind of your launch and where you're going moving forward. So, you know, one of the key things to me that stands out about your team is you've taken a very, in my opinion, or my phrase, kind of a developer first approach so far at Dharma. And I think I've seen this as well at 0x, and you just mentioned them as well, that you've learned a lot from them. Can you kind of talk about this approach and what it means in your eyes?
Yeah, you know, I think that the one thing that I'd caveat is like our sort of approach that we take as a company to building out this system has been shifting as of recent. So, you know, like while I would definitely agree that we had taken a very sort of developer first purist sort of approach in, you know, the first 6 months that we were live, I'd say we're definitely starting to move to a perspective where we think that, you know, like the highest leverage kind of way in which, you know, no pun intended, the highest leverage way in which we can give this network more adoption and liquidity is to kind of bring it to market ourselves and bring and build like the successful product on top of it. But, you know, perhaps I'll walk you through where we kind of started, you know, how we've shifted away from that and, you know, what our relationship is nowadays with our developer community. And so, you know, when we originally started, we really kind of set out to emulate the 0x model. We really wanted to build like this pure platform that is as generic and as extensible as possible, build a bunch of developer tooling that makes it really easy for people to build applications on top of that and make kind of like our top line metric developer adoption and kind of put that first and foremost. And we had some great early success in that regard in that, you know, we had two venture funded businesses build Relayers on top of Dharma. We had a whole set of really awesome and exciting projects that were in the pipeline that we had heard of. But we also were at a point where we didn't feel like liquidity in the network had really kind of reached the levels that we wanted to see. And I think we kind of started to realize that we had built this great awareness around what we were doing and this great brand and had hired all these fantastic product people who were really excited about seeing certain things built on top of Dharma, but were kind of sitting in a little bit of a backseat. And so the natural conclusion for us was, well, you know, there are two types of entities in Dharma, and we can talk about this in a second. But, you know, like one of them is called Relayer and one of them is called an underwriter. Up until now, we had only had Relayers present in the ecosystem. And underwriters, at least per our design of the protocol, are kind of like the main actors responsible for sourcing borrowers. And in this ecosystem in particular, in the you know, emerging DeFi space, borrowers are the scarce asset. Like that's what's harder to find. And so we decided to just kind of tackle the hardest problem in a way that's, in our opinion, kind of like a net add to our ecosystem in general. And so right now we have kind of shifted to focusing on building the first underwriter in the Dharma ecosystem, which is called Dharma Lever. And we'll talk perhaps more deeply about that later in the interview. But that's kind of that is the approach that we've taken now. And we have this very sort of, we have a very challenging like line to walk that we're going to have to kind of perfect here of maintaining both a fantastic first-class product, but also maintaining a, you know, open permissionless platform where people know that we don't have any sort of incentive misalignment with them in building in our ecosystem.
Nice. Yeah. And I think that's a great segue to kind of where I wanted to go next as well. And, you know, you have a very detailed white paper. I would suggest people to go read it. It's detailed, but it's easy to read and understand. And in there, it describes Dharma as a four-party system. So everyone, I guess, is very familiar with the concept of debtors and creditors. Those are the two parties on either side of a loan or a loan agreement. Then we have relayers, which is very similar to kind of how 0x works, where relayers are taking orders and broadcasting them let's say on top of a UI to people that eventually are looking for these loans or want to fill them. What's interesting in Dharma's case is what you just mentioned are the underwriters. And to me, this is a very critical aspect of lending. And I have a couple questions around this aspect, but can you just kind of walk us through this four-part system and how they all play together on top of Dharma?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the best place to start is with the relayers, as you mentioned. For your listeners that are familiar with the 0x protocol, this is, you know, extremely similar to that concept. Basically, relayers and 0x host kind of centralized order books that accumulate like orders from different makers and takers for exchanges of crypto tokens. In Dharma, the same sort of paradigm is leveraged, but instead of makers and takers, we are connecting borrowers and lenders. So, you know, naively, if we're just dealing with only a relayer, a borrower can show up on a relayer's doorstep. They can sign what we call a debt order, broadcast that order onto the relayer's order book, and then a creditor can kind of peruse that relayer's order book and see that order and then choose to fill it themselves, thereby kind of earning the relayer a fee and initiating the loan agreement between the creditor and debtor. And so, you know, for classes of loans in which like the default protection mechanisms are baked into the smart contracts themselves, i.e., you know, like actually crypto collateralized loans, you don't necessarily need something like an underwriter. Like you don't necessarily need somebody to come in and vouch for the borrower, so to speak. But in the context of you know, like more unsecured loans, that's where the concept of underwriter started to come in. So, you know, like it's pretty hunky dory that you can go to this order book and find other borrowers and lenders, but how can you know that you can trust them? How can you know what the odds are that they're going to actually pay you back? And in turn, how can you essentially price the risk of your investment as a lender? And so this is where underwriters come in. The high level mandate for an underwriter is to originate borrowers, sort of provide an attestation of their predicted risk of default, commit to that attestation, like cryptographically, and then if that loan is ever actually filled, the underwriter not only earns some sort of fee, but also their prediction is sort of immutably recorded into the loan registry, meaning that at any time in the future, I could go onto the blockchain and look at all the predictions an underwriter has made in the past and assess how they have played out against the reality of those loans' default status. And so I can start to basically build a sort of reputation as an underwriter in this system. And so earlier, you know, I mentioned that like we have yet to have had third-party underwriters join the ecosystem. And so we chose to build the first one with Lever. And so the idea here is like, you know, what we're doing with Dharma Lever is we are originating borrowers to our platform. We are displaying to them different loan offers from the Dharma credit market that we have sourced from relayers such as Blockboard. And then essentially, if they choose to accept that offer, we are going to underwrite the loan. We are going to vouch for the borrower and the creditworthiness of this loan. And the reason why we feel comfortable vouching for the creditworthiness of the loan is that it is secured on chain, and the liquidation processes that would go into, you know, like if this loan needs to be margin called, are going to be kind of taken care of by us as Dharma Lever. So even though the whole process is managed by smart contracts and, you know, we don't have the ability to cheat the system per se, you know, somebody has to come in and be at the ready to provide the liquidity to liquidate a secured loan if need be. And so this is our service that we're providing to the network as an underwriter in this context. Our hope is that by building kind of the first underwriter in the ecosystem and having the first kind of like fully fledged and fully functioning version of this four-party system active in production, and having that happen at, you know, a hopefully high volume, then we're going to be able to attract more relayers into the system. We're going to be able to attract other underwriters into the system, and we can really start to kind of see what this system looks like in, you know, in its idealized form.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, to me, one of the key aspects are the underwriters, right? And kind of we've seen across the decentralized finance space so far very high collateralization ratios, which means that you have to have a lot of collateral to take out a loan, right? So I believe on MakerDAI, well, I know on MakerDAI and Compound, that's 150%. So, you know, your loan that you can take out is obviously less than the collateral you have to put down. And one of the reasons for this are there's a lack of underwriters, there's a lack of people vouching for lenders. And it sounds like you guys are trying to build this up so that people can trust, obviously this is all anonymous, people can kind of trust the other side of the loan. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah. I'd say that that's like the generalized way of phrasing the mandate there.
And are you hopeful that these can kind of bring down, like I would think that a lot of people are going to want to take riskier loans for a higher interest and on the other side for a lower collateralization ratio. Are you thinking that you're going to be able to get these numbers down, well, down on the collateralization side and up on the interest side for like riskier loans?
Yeah. So I think that the way that, you know, in the short term, like it's likely that we will continue to see these sort of over collateralized loans be the norm in the decentralized financial space. For the exact reason that you pointed out, it's just, you know, there's a certain trust and identity component that you have to start to integrate in at that point. What I would also emphasize, though, is I think that people overestimate how far that is away. Like really, in Dharma today, we could have gone and in trying to build the first underwriter in the network, have built an underwriter for unsecured loans and, you know, have done all these sorts of identity and risk assessment work off chain using whatever proprietary systems we have and acted still as an underwriter in like the broader Dharma credit market. And this is, mind you, by design. This is exactly our intention for how we want Dharma to work. The biggest blocker there isn't necessarily a lack of an ability to you know, of good like identity frameworks or of good like credit scoring libraries and what have you. And, you know, all those tools are pretty readily available nowadays. Like people, you know, tons of people have went and built fintech companies off the backs of these tools. The problem is that it's just really hard to use cryptocurrencies for anything but speculation today, right? Like for the average consumer. And so if you're going to start underwriting loans, like you at the end of the day need to underwrite a lot more good borrowers than you do bad borrowers. And the problem is that like, it, you know, good borrowers for unsecured loans, you know, it's not that easy to go and take your DAI and buy groceries with it, at least for now. And so really we chose to kind of focus more so on what people are interested in doing today, which is trading. And we'll talk a bit more later about this, but, you know, I think that the way that we eventually start to get to a world in which not every loan has to be super highly collateralized is you start to mix in some sort of notion of identity. Like I think, but I think it happens incrementally. I don't think that we go straight to a world in which people are getting unsecured loans so much as like we go to a world in which if you have taken out 10 loans of $10,000 and successfully repaid them back, and we have like, you know, your email and identity information in Dharma Lever, that we will start to be like willing to lower your required collateralization ratio that we are willing to vouch for you on. But again, this would have to happen kind of like incrementally. And I view that as like a really important middle stone between where we are today, where all loans are highly over collateralized, to an eventual future in which we can actually do things like unsecured loans.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a big step for the space. And you kind of mentioned right now people are just used to these crypto to crypto loans, which obviously are being used for trading. How do you kind of envision this progressing forward, even outside of the identity space and kind of lowering these collateral requirements? But do you see Dharma moving past just crypto to crypto loans, maybe on securitized or tokenized housing and different tokenized assets, maybe even like NFTs and things like that? Like, kind of where do you see that evolving?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So I really think that like tokenized securities, I'm excited about. I think it's definitely the future. It's just a question to me of like what the time horizon is. Like it's unclear to me whether it's like a in the next 5 years sort of thing, or if it's in the next like 15 years sort of thing. Mind you, like, you know, we're all kind of in that limbo right now. So it's not like you could make the same argument about Dharma. You know, in terms of our strategic priorities, I wouldn't say that we spend as much time focusing on tokenized securities. What I'd be really interested in seeing as a prerequisite for a lot of the things like Dharma and other sort of decentralized financial providers being more useful would be like really, really graceful like off-ramps and on-ramps for crypto from like dollars to stable coins. And we're actually kind of starting to get there. Like we're getting really close, like really, really close. You know, last year was like the year of the stable coin. We had all these stable coins launch. And now all of a sudden there's like, you know, two fiat on-ramps that I can think of for stable coins already, and many more coming. And so I really think we're like, as soon as you get to that world in which like it actually is feasible for you to like cash out your DAI, USD coin, whatever, into US dollars relatively quickly and relatively seamlessly in a way that's like abstracted away from the user, like that changes everything. Like that really, really opens up an entire new world of financial services that we can offer. And so like, really at that point, you've kind of started crossing the realm into like the whole world of existing financial services. And that's a really exciting prospect to me. But, you know, I think the first step there is just like making this stuff easier for people to use.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I fully agree with that. It's crazy how fast DAI adoption is coming along. I mean, I was just messing with the Austin Griffiths burner wallet for XDAI today. And it's so cool. Like, it's amazing how fast and essentially feeless you can send DAI to people. And like you mentioned, now there's so many on and off ramps, either, you know, Gemini or Coinbase, or I believe it's called Wire. There's a lot of places to kind of get on and off. And I know of people that are sending Ether to CDPs just because they don't want to sell it for DAI for whatever reason. And they're opening a CDP and taking some DAI out and kind of playing with it in the ecosystem. So I think we're seeing a lot of really cool options come online with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, kind of an interesting thought experiment. We talk a lot about this a lot, at least Anthony and I have a lot on our weekly recaps. And, you know, I love this open finance system. I'm super bullish on it. But at the same time, I have some fears around it, and especially around kind of the interoperability of all of these platforms and products that are being created. I have a bit of a fear that it's going to lead to some very exotic financial instruments that could cause a big risk event. And if Ethereum kind of becomes the global financial system for the internet, potentially could cause some kind of massive failure of that system in the future. Do you agree with this? And kind of what do you think we can do to prevent this in the future?
Yeah, I mean, like I definitely think it's a possibility, right? Like it's not, I can't say it's like it will definitely happen or will definitely not, but it's very, very possible, right? Like you're with any sort of democratizing technology that allows people to like do really innovative things with large sums of money, like there's going to be money lost in some sorts of accidents or mishaps. The question is just like what scale it happens at. Like the DAO hack was like, you know, a massive jarring psychological event at the time, but I would argue that it's really paid itself off in terms of dividends for the community, because, you know, we all learned that you need to do audits. We all learned that you need to take smart contract security very seriously, et cetera. The what's scary is that like we would enter this kind of like this scenario in the future where there's just a ton, like the system, like these open financial systems are like crazy over leveraged and are kind of like built like houses of cards where, you know, you have multiple systems stacked on top of DAI, which is in itself kind of a synthetic system. And then you have people creating all sorts of exotic instruments on top of that and exotic prediction markets on the side. Like, you know, this whole system can get to a point where it's really hard to analyze its systemic risk, like very, very quickly. And I definitely think it is possible that something calamitously bad could happen as a result. Now, with, you know, that doom and gloom acknowledgement aside, you know, what's awesome about these systems too at the same time is that they're just wholly transparent. Like in 2008, when there was a ton of latent systemic risk that was building up in the system, there was a very, very kind of small cadre of people who largely worked on Wall Street who would have been qualified and able to detect kind of this impending financial disaster. Whereas with open financial systems, anybody can go and write a snarky blog post saying the house of cards is going to come tumbling down. And I think that that's really important because like that sort of openness, while it doesn't necessarily prevent these sorts of issues happening, it makes them much less likely to lie undetected for a long time.
Yeah, fully agree with that. I think it's an interesting thought experiment. I always kind of joke someone's going to have like a crypto kitty 10 times short on a decentralized exchange, and we're going to have all this insane leverage. I hope kind of projects, you said it well, measuring the risk in the system. I kind of hope some projects come online to kind of help with this and analyze it. And to your point, that's pretty easy to do because they're so open. I will say it's going to be interesting. I know there's an EIP out there now for zero knowledge ERC-20s. So it's going to be interesting to see as privacy features come online, you know, how much more complex it becomes to kind of trace all this stuff.
That's a huge point, right? Like there's, but it's interesting, right? Like you could build zero knowledge circuits that in some capacity, like, you know, I'm going to butcher the explanation of this, but I think there are ways in which you could build opt-in features to these systems such that they could like provide analytical insights to other systems on a kind of global basis as opposed to on like a localized basis. Like for instance, you could have like a zero knowledge DEX that only kind of gave you like the daily transactional volume, but it wouldn't give you any sort of individual transactional information. And so I think you know, I with all of these systems, I think there's a caveat and an interesting technological way in which we can kind of make sure that we maintain these properties of transparency, or at least global transparency or systemic transparency that we care about.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. On the system level, we should still be able to analyze it, even if some of these zero knowledge solutions are in place. So before we kind of dive into Dharma Lever, which you've mentioned a little bit, and I know it's your new product, I quickly on the kind of existing, you know, I guess I'll call it OG Dharma at this point. If there's people listening and they're curious, they want to go out there and play around with the system, are there third-party tools out there for them to go look at, like Relayers, and where would you direct them to go take a look at, you know, loan offers?
Yeah, 100%. So if you go to blockboard.com, so BLOQ and then board.com, they are our first Relayer that's in our ecosystem. You can go on there, you can play around, you can take out loans via Dharma, you can also invest in compound money markets, you can invest in a lot of really, really cool stuff. So I really recommend listeners check out that platform.
Nice. And kind of one final question. I asked most of the guests this, and it's a classic kind of open source built on Ethereum type problem. But on your base layer, you know, as I understand it, there's no fees baked in. So you guys aren't charging people to make loans or anything like that. Kind of what is your long-term plan for monetization of the product?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're taking it one step at a time. Like at the moment, the monetization strategy for Lever is extremely lucid, right? Like really, it really just comes down to like Lever is an underwriter in the Dharma ecosystem. Underwriters in the Dharma ecosystem get paid out a predefined fee on an order by order basis that is invested in by a lender. And so there's a pretty clear way for us to be making money there, which is very akin to the way that like originators in the traditional financial system make their money when they kind of bring borrowers to the doorsteps of banks. And so it's basically, that's basically the model there. As to what it's going to look like in the long term, it's hard to say. You know, like I think that like the jury is very much out there as to like what is the best way to capture value in these kind of shared settlement systems like Dharma, Jira, X. And I'd say that we're still figuring it out one day at a time.
So I guess that's a perfect segue into kind of diving a little bit deeper into Dharma Lever. Kind of as you put it earlier, it's your team's attempt to kind of fill in that fourth and I guess almost most important aspect, which is the underwriting aspect. So you guys right now are kind of acting as an underwriter and you're using this tool to do that. You touched on it a little bit, but can you just kind of walk through, you know, if I'm a user and I go to Dharma Lever, I think you guys are invite only right now, kind of what you offer and what I would see as an end user?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I've kind of liked using as a one-liner for Dharma Lever is that it's kind of like trustless shapeshift for loans. So, you know, it kind of looks and feels a lot like a shapeshift where you kind of show up, you say, I want to borrow, X asset collateralized by like Y asset. And then we're going to go and kind of like scan over the crypto over the Dharma credit market, go through different relayers order books and kind of find you the best loan offer that's out there per your parameters, and then essentially give you like this really nice meta transactions enabled way of investing in that loan or borrowing from that loan offer without having to use something like MetaMask. And so we're really excited about the system because essentially you can use it from any cryptocurrency wallet, even something like Coinbase. And so we're excited because we think this really sort of broadens the total addressable market for these financial services from, you know, what are just Ethereum enthusiasts who are willing to do things like install MetaMask to cryptocurrency users in general. So that's what you can kind of imagine is that it's kind of like a very neatly productized experience for borrowing and lending from the Dharma credit market without having to be exposed to the innards of Ethereum dApps.
That sounds really cool. I've checked it out a little bit. I think you guys have a cool product here. And I'm sure a lot of people listening are familiar with Compound and kind of hearing, you know, two sides, lending and borrowing and kind of the matching of borrowers and lenders in that platform. Sounds a little bit similar to Lever, but I know the products are actually quite different. Just given that people are very familiar with Compound, and I bet a lot of listeners have actually used it. Can you just kind of walk through how the two products are different?
Definitely. Compound and Dharma are very different products in that Compound is a money market and Dharma is a peer-to-peer lending market. There's kind of a trade-off matrix here of what you get from both of them. With Compound Finance, the most obvious advantage that you get is that you can at any time start lending and start accruing interest right away. And you can at any time kind of like borrow from the system. And there's not like any sort of like latency. Like everything is kind of like instantly dispersed to you. And that's fantastic. Like that's a really, really cool experience. The problem, though, is that like structurally, the way that a money market works puts at least at least in the current dynamic of the crypto credit markets, it creates like really wonky conditions for interest rates on both the borrow and lend side. So, for instance, on Compound, in the broader credit market for cryptocurrencies, there's way more people that want to lend out their crypto assets than there are people who are willing to borrow them. The reason being that just like, you know, a lot of people hold on to things like ETH and aren't planning on selling it anytime soon. And there's not really good interest bearing options for storing your ETH anywhere. And so there's kind of like an oversupply compared to the people who are looking to borrow those cryptocurrencies for trading purposes. And so what you end up with is that on a money market like Compound, when you have, say, 10 lenders in a money market and then one borrower, all 10 of those lenders have to get paid the same interest rate, and that borrower has to pay like a kind of singular interest rate as well. And so you end up with a dynamic where essentially if there's a glut of supply on the lend side and kind of a paucity of demand on the borrow side, then interest rates for lenders are going to have to be very, very low on a per lender basis. And then interest rates for borrowers are going to have to be very high on a per borrower basis in order to kind of compensate the broader pool of lenders. And this creates kind of almost like the opposite of a virtuous cycle where the interest rate thereby gets higher for borrowers, which discourages borrowers from entering the market in the first place. Which means that now the less borrowers that are coming into the system now have to pay a higher interest rate. And so again, you're really talking about trade-offs here. Like it's trade-off between having kind of instant access to a credit facility either on the borrow side or on the lend side, or having kind of this dynamic where interest rates can often like not really map to a rational reality. Now, the way that Dharma works is that Dharma is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace, meaning that 10 lenders can come on the system and put out offers to lend out one ETH each, but not all 10 of those people are going to get their loan matched, right? So if there are 10 lenders and one borrower, and all 10 of those lenders want to lend out one ETH, and that one borrower wants to borrow one ETH, then only one of those lenders is going to walk away earning some sort of interest rate. And so you can kind of think of this as being like, I almost like to think of it as like, I take it you're familiar with Uniswap.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So I would say like it's like Compound is to Uniswap as like Dharma is to like 0x, right? Like it's like the difference between having like a sort of automated two-sided marketplace that where kind of orders are constantly being matched and readjusted as opposed to like a open order book in which like matching happens on a one-to-one basis between borrowers and lenders.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's a great explanation. And we had a Compound episode about 2 weeks ago and kind of walked through that, and you explained it perfectly. I mean, if the pool size on, say, Compound is way different, you're going to see a very large spread. For example, right now, I think you can lend DAI at 3% and you can borrow it at like 8.5%. So obviously there's a big spread there. That's because the pool sizes are a lot different. So you're having to pay one side a lot more, taking from a smaller side and paying it out to a larger side. So it sounds like on Dharma Lever, you're kind of matching up lenders and borrowers. And I know right now it's in an invite only mode. I'm curious though, kind of what does the average customer or loan look like? Like, what are you seeing as far as maybe average loan size and rate paid on both the lending and borrowing side?
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is that like I can tell you what we've seen people want to do and what we've seen people are doing. The reason why there's a distinction between the two is that we have been setting very, very aggressive limits on people on how much they can borrow and lend, because we want the system to kind of like build a sort of a Lindy effect of stability around it before we feel comfortable kind of lifting the reins off of it and letting people use it unencumbered. But, you know, what people have been telling us, like, you know, generally speaking, like people want to be doing loans on the orders of like hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like that is kind of the customer base that we have been trying to target, is people who really want to borrow and lend cryptocurrencies in high volume. And the reason why we're targeting these people is because we think that that is the demographic of traders that is most underserved at the moment by the existing solutions, right? Because like if you're just a casual trader who's kind of playing around, you can go onto Bitfinex and get like a relatively good rate on like a margin loan. But if you're like a more serious trader and you're doing things that have, you know, like four figure, five figure, you know, so on and so forth sizes to them, your best options are going through an OTC desk. And that's like an extremely opaque process in terms of understanding whether you're getting a great rate or you're getting kind of fleeced. And so, you know, that's kind of who we've been targeting so far. And we're really excited to kind of continue rolling out Lever and see how well we're able to serve that demographic.
Gotcha. And given that Dharma is acting as the underwriter, I know you said you haven't really kind of opened it up too far yet as far as size goes, but does that mean that you guys are taking all of the risk and the default risk on your side, or is there any risk to the lender at all right now?
So the risks that exist right now are probably much more structural. It's just around like, you know, does the system function correctly? And so, you know, we have been very explicit with our early alpha partners that we are, you know, up to a kind of reasonable degree willing to compensate them for any losses that are based on failures of the smart contracts. Now, with that being said, like, you know, the system is still a fully kind of crypto over collateralized system. So if the system is operating correctly, then in theory, there should not be risk of capital loss for the lender. Theory is not practice, though. And, you know, there's a whole list of factors that would, or, you know, scenarios that would lead to a lender losing money. But, you know, eventually, I think we're going to be able to get to a point where we can reasonably give a borrower, or rather a lender, a prediction of the likelihood of a loan defaulting on the basis of like how liquid and volatile the collateral is in comparison to the principal, and just use that to kind of like calculate via a model the kind of risk of the loan and be able to predict that to a reasonable accuracy. such that, you know, a lender could intelligently price that loan.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's where it starts to get very exciting for sure. So right now, does that mean on Lever, there's kind of a set collateralization requirement?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right now we are requiring loans be initially 150% over collateralized.
Okay. Yeah. It's everyone's favorite number.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Everyone's kind of used to it at this point. So, you know, I think that's a great kind of dive into, I guess, initially your background and then how Dharma got started and all the great things you guys are doing. I think Lever is a very cool tool. If people are interested in getting involved with Lever right now, how can they go about that? Is there kind of a waiting list for that, or how does that work?
Yes, absolutely. So if you go to lever.dharma.io, you can request an invite to the wait list, and we'd love to get in touch and see if you'd be a good fit for the Alpha program.
Just in thinking through this, do customers have to go through some kind of KYC for this?
Yes, they do, unfortunately. I think that is, you know, if we are planning on being a business that in some way accepts fees at any point in the future, there's not really a great way of getting around that requirement. However, we would like to, when we implement that in a productized form, do it in a way that's like very like Web3 native. Like we do want to kind of be on the vanguard of leveraging open identity standards and things like that. And so hopefully we can do it in a way where your identity is portable outside of just Dharma.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, in all honesty, if you're looking to lend or borrow a very large amount of crypto like that, I mean, you've pretty much got to be open to KYC at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
I think people that are at least given that option are going to be fine to do that. So I don't really see it as that big of a deal.
Yeah, we certainly haven't seen pushback on it so far.
Yeah, that's good. So, you know, I kind of want to shift a little bit into some more general questions. I always kind of like to wrap up the interview with a little more lighthearted questions, I guess I would say. So first, there's a lot of debate about open finance versus decentralized finance. where do you stand on this? Or do you have a different term, or kind of what are your thoughts around this?
Oh, man. Okay. So I'd say in the long form sentence, I'd say that open finance to me is better. Like, in that, like, I think it communicates the concept in a way that is more resonant with people that aren't in the cryptocurrency community. Like decentralized doesn't mean anything to most people. Like that is a non-word to most people outside of this space. And so I think open finance communicates that better. Now, that being said, I think DeFi just has a ring to it that is just really hard to recreate. And I am heavily on the camp that supports kind of keeping that meme alive and continuing to spread it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's hashtag DeFi, but if you're actually using it in a sentence, then we use open finance. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly. The open finance movement and then DeFi.
Right, exactly. Definitely. So I wanted to talk a little bit about scaling. I had recently tweeted out that I actually don't think open finance really needs layer one scaling to be successful. I think, you know, the efforts around what is being called Ethereum 1.x and then layer two solutions will be enough. Do you agree with that statement?
You know, to a certain degree, right? Like I think it depends. Like, well, first of all, it depends on what you define as being part of open finance, right? Like if payments is a part of open finance, then like, yeah, 100% we need like some sort of like scaling solution. Like that, you know, our current system does not scale well for everyday payments. But if we're talking about things like Dharma or talking about things like Maker, you know, I think we have some time. Like I really do think like these are not high TPS activities. Like these are high transactional value activities. Where you're willing to pay often a high premium in terms of gas costs because the notional value of the trade or leverage or whatever it is that you're doing is high enough to justify it. And so I think like there's a clock on that. Like that's not going to last forever. Like, you know, if the whole world started using MakerDAO, like the Ethereum chain would collapse. And so like, obviously there's a certain limit to that, but I think I would say that the open finance movement is significantly less urgently in need of Ethereum scaling. So Ethereum scaling is not something that keeps me up at night a lot. With that being said, I'm really excited about a lot of stuff that's happening in ETH2. I actually think that they're on a really great track. It will be interesting to see how projects like ours that are kind of establishing what is frankly like a semi-permanent foothold on the Ethereum base chain, how we're going to navigate the move to ETH2 if and when that happens.
Yeah, I actually think that's a fascinating conversation I've been diving a little bit more into now. And just for people with a background, although we talk about the phases a lot on here, but you know, it's not until phase two that we'll have state transitions in ETH 2.0. And probably not even then we're going to have things like cross-shard transactions. So essentially, if you dApps might start living on the same shard if they need to communicate with each other, there's a lot of complexities around that. So, you know, I'll be very interested to see kind of A, how long the ETH 1.0 chain lives or stays long, and then kind of how long it takes some dApps, even like yourself and you guys over at Dharma, kind of what your plan is for transitioning.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say like, it's hard to say, it's so early. And you know, we try not to like form plans around things that have like barely even been specified yet, but it's, I would say that it is easier for like the Dharma protocols and 0x's of the world to reason around this than it is for, say, Maker, because Maker has a really challenging problem on their hand, which is that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of state locked up in their kind of contracts on the Ethereum based chain. And so there's a really interesting conversation to be had about how that sort of system gets transitioned over to ETH2, as opposed to something like Dharma, which, like, you know, there is state on a loan by loan basis, but not that much state on a global Dharma basis. And so I foresee that we have less issues of migrating that system to a new blockchain.
Yeah, the next few years are definitely going to be a very interesting time, that's for sure. No lack of things happening and keeping track of.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So I guess just kind of one last question outside of the open finance space that, or I guess hashtag DeFi that we've been talking about the whole time. What are some of your favorite projects that are teams that are out there right now?
Oh man. Let's see. So does Augur count as part of open finance? I feel like that's,
I guess it's debatable. I've seen yes and no.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would say that yes is the case there. Well, first of all, I'll give a quick shout out to Vail, even though this is definitely kind of still part of arguably part of the open finance movement, but Vail is just a hell of a team, and they built like an amazing UI on top of Augur, and I'm just really excited about the idea of like usable products being built on top of crypto outside of the open finance movement. Yeah, I mean, like I've always been really interested in NFTs and gaming. Like I really think that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And the first things that a lot of people of my generation did on the internet were like stupid flash games. And I think that's like what educated a whole generation of people into like what it is to use an internet service, you know, kind of turned that generation of people into like crypto native, or rather internet native, you know, kids. And I think that, you know, maybe this is like a little bit of like loose pattern matching, but I think that there's something similar to be said about crypto, and that like, I think that people who are building various forms of like gaming systems on top of crypto, be they, you know, like crypto collectibles integrated into a gaming environment, or, you know, some sort of like crypto gambling system, or, you know, like things like FOMO 3D, which are these kind of like weird, wonky, like community game experiments. Like, I just think those things are really awesome. And like, I think that just like cool technologies, like kind of see a lot of their first adoptions in very playful environments. And I think that that's kind of an underrated aspect of the industry that I don't think people are paying enough attention to. And that for all we know, there could be something kind of very, very high leverage to our broader ecosystem's adoption in that space.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're going to see a lot of kind of smaller, like you said, kind of almost like addictive little games pop up. And I think one of the most interesting things is, I don't know if you followed the ETH Trader Reddit and how they had.
Right. The donuts thing. Yeah, exactly. It's like that sort of stuff. You're like, whoa, like it's like real time social engineering happening. And it's like, it's just crazy. Like that's where you realize that this stuff is just really powerful, that you can just spin up economies and like in a matter of like weeks and have just like massive controversies stir up as a result. Like, it's fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Something that had value on a system on Reddit, like Karma Points, all of a sudden within 30 minutes was tokenized and were being traded for value for Ether. I mean, it's fascinating. And I saw some of the Reddit admins talking about maybe keeping track of Karma on Ethereum smart contracts and stuff now. So I think it's things like that that are going to pop up and just kind of catch wildfire that'll kind of push us on the adoption front.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
So I think this has been a great conversation. What's the best way for people to kind of follow you and your team and all the progress that you guys are making?
Yeah, so I would go, first of all, we have started this newsletter called the Dharma Markets Report, and we're essentially, we kind of like give it an analysis of the crypto credit markets as they're evolving in real time, particularly in the hashtag DeFi or open finance ecosystem. And so I would recommend folks sign up for that. We can, if you go to our Twitter, which is at Dharma Protocol, you'll find a link to sign up to it there. I would also just recommend following our Twitter in general. I think it's a great source for hearing news about what's going on with us. And lastly, I think if you go to dharma.io, there's all sorts of fun email newsletters and the Dharma Lever waitlist and stuff that you can sign up for if you want to get updates there.
Great, great. Well, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and thanks a lot for joining me today, Nadav.
Yeah, absolutely, Eric. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.